following program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Now, the caravan of illegal immigrants is coming from Central America to our border. They've already gone through Mexico City. They're only a few hundred miles away. It's grown to a whopping 5,000 to 6,000 people, and it gets bigger by the hour. Now, they're determined to bum rush the border to crash it, and if they get through, if this 5,000 gets through, it'll be 50,000 tomorrow and 500,000 after that. That's why we need to build the wall now. If we don't have a border, you don't have a country. You have a landmass. Congress has put this off and put this off for months, but they're about to take up funding for the wall in the lame duck session. They need to get this done. Liberals want to abolish ICE and let everyone in, including criminals. Big business on Wall Street, well, they want cheap labor. They want to drive shareholder value. They don't really care what happens. They just want a bigger check at the end of the month. So they let everyone in, too. This is the unholy alliance of all time. Now, you can't let them have that their way because Congress needs to hear from us in no uncertain terms. This is our country. Call Congress. Tell them, build the wall now. You got a phone? Dial it out. 202-224-3121. 202-224-3121. This message paid for and authorized by America First Policies Incorporated. Joining us now, Corey Lewandowski, campaign manager for President Trump 2015-16. Engineered the great victory. Corey also is an author of one book that's already come out that's a must read called Let Trump Be Trump. That's number one. Number two is he's got another book coming out in like a week, November 20th, called Trump's Enemies from Within, where he's not going to pull any punches and he's going to name names and he's going to call out the never Trumpers running around the White House, running around the West Wing, running around the agencies. And he's with us now, first time on since the midterms. He's also a senior policy advisor to the vice president's political action committee. Corey, great to have you.
Well, good morning, John. How are you today?
Never better. Your assessment of the midterms?
You know, my assessment is the Democrats have picked up 30 seats in the House right now. There are 10 seats still in play. They're leading about five of those, which looks like you'll have a net gain of about 35 seats, giving them a majority, but not a huge majority, which was to be expected. It is better than historical averages or right in line with the historical average. It is much better than what Barack Obama did in his first midterm or Bill Clinton did in his first midterm in the House. But, John, the numbers in the Senate to me are what are most disappointing. While the Republicans were successful in defeating what should be three incumbent U.S. senators, and I mean Florida, North Dakota, and Missouri, we were unsuccessful in holding the seats in Nevada and now Arizona, and missed some opportunities in very, very close races like Montana. And so, you know, honestly, I was hoping for a better night. I like the fact that we're going to have a bigger majority in the U.S. Senate. There was no question we were going to hold the Senate, but I want to see a bigger majority because what I saw was in places where the candidates embraced Donald Trump, put their arms around him, gave him a big bear hug and said, we're with you on the Trump-Pence agenda. Those are the candidates that won, and I wish we had more of those running last cycle.
Okay, well, let's evaluate that because I agree with you. McSally was a never-Trumper from the start. She had to get on stage with him at the end because she had no choice. The thing was tied or she was behind. She lost. Dean Heller, as you know, was a never-Trumper in the Senate from day one. He lost. Probably the biggest defeat for a Trump supporter was Rosendale in Montana. I actually thought he would win, so I was very disappointed in that. But you're right, and the president called some of these congressmen out. Those that ran away from the president, they all got beat, right? Except Rosendale.
They did. You're exactly right. And look, I look at Andy Barr in Kentucky. Kentucky 6th District, it was a district where the Democrats targeted. It was the first race to close on election night. He asked for the president to come in and help him. The president went to Kentucky 6th District. He won that district. Andy Barr is coming back to Congress as a member of Congress because he embraced the Trump-Pence agenda. And, you know, look, people remember, and I like Dean Heller and Martha McSally, and I'd rather have them in the U.S. Senate than their opponents. But people remember that when you say things about this president, that they hold you accountable at the ballot box. And Dean Heller came around and supported the president in the last year of his election campaign. And, you know, but the truth is, John, I really want to win in Montana. I know the president wants to win in Montana, particularly after what Senator John Tester did to Admiral Jackson. I'm surprised that the people of Montana sent him back to Washington, D.C., because he does not hold their values. And, you know, this should be a lesson for anybody that is thinking about running in 2 years from now, that with Donald Trump on the ballot, with Mike Pence on the ballot, your choices are to run with them or to run away from them. And when I look at Carlos Cabello and Mike Kaufman and Mia Love and so many of the other candidates who didn't want to be associated with the Trump-Pence team, they're all former members of Congress now.
Well, it goes a little deeper than that. It even cuts to Virginia. Scott Taylor lost in the 2nd District. I wouldn't call Scott a never-Trumper, but at the end, he distanced himself in his final interview with the Virginia Pilot. You know, he said he didn't embrace a lot of the president's style or policies. He got trounced, actually, got beat handily by Elaine Loria. Our good friend Dave Bratt in the 7th District was a Trump supporter, but the problem we had, he never had Trump down here because they had to deal with the ridiculous Corey Stewart issue with Confederate flags and running around with photo ops with people in Charlottesville. And so you had a lot of odd issues going on with various people. But, Corey, you're right. I mean, other than Dave here in Virginia, we lost 2 seats. Both of them ran away from Trump. In fact, he called Barbara out, as you know, at the press conference on Wednesday and basically ended her career by doing that. So, but it is what it is. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. But I think if you look at, Corey, tell me if I'm wrong. You look at the 202 seats that were likely to retain in Congress for the Republican side. None of those now going into 2020, in my mind, are at risk because they weathered the toughest storm they're going to weather, right?
Well, that's right. Look, the last cycle that we just finished now a week ago today was the Democrats' holy grail when it came to the House. They were running an opposition campaign, and now they're going to have to run in their records. They have been the party of no, and that means no ideas, no values, no future. But now that they're in control, it's going to be very difficult because, John, as you know, there are almost 24 members who ran on a campaign of not supporting Nancy Pelosi for Speaker of the House. The very first vote that they're going to make is very likely to be a lie to their constituents because they are going to support Nancy Pelosi for Speaker. And so right off the bat, they're going to have to go back and they're going to have to go to their constituents and say, well, I said we weren't going to support Nancy Pelosi. We didn't have an alternative. And so, yes, we lied to you. And then they're going to have to run on their record. And their record is going to be one of obstruction, one of, look, they've already outlined what their record is. Today they're saying that gun control is the priority for the Democrats in Congress. That and investigating the president and all of the parts of the administration. I think they've said they've got somewhere around 84 investigations that they want to launch. How does that help the American people is the question. Mm-hmm. So these Democrats who won in some of these places, which were a little surprising, I'll tell you what, they're going to have a very difficult time in 2 years. And, you know, John, I don't know if your listeners read this piece, but there was a piece in Axios today, and it couldn't be more dreary on the outlook for the president. He could lose in Wisconsin. He could lose in Pennsylvania. He could lose in Michigan. Well, now they're saying that he didn't win those states. Hillary Clinton actually lost those states. So Donald Trump's chances for reelection, according to the Axios piece today, are, you know, not very good. I fundamentally disagree with it. These are the same prognosticators who told us that Donald Trump was going to lose in the biggest landslide election since Ronald Reagan's reelection effort. And I just don't believe this stuff. It is Trump against the mainstream media every single day, and he's proven them wrong time and time again. So your listeners have to just take everything with a grain of salt, I think, John. They have to understand that those members of Congress who won on Tuesday night are going to have to now run on their record, which is going to be a record of bringing the country in the wrong direction. And in 2 years from now, when Donald Trump is on the ballot and all of the Trump people show up and vote, it's going to have very different results.
And the Democrats will have about a 12 to 13 seat majority, something like that. 15 of those seats that they won, Trump carried their congressional district in 2016. You get Trump on the ballot in 2020 with a track record behind them, he's going to carry those districts again. Every one of those 15 is going to be at risk. So, Corey, if you really look at this and you look going into 18, all the headwinds were against the Republicans maintaining control, all the people who retired, all the never Trumpers, all of the Republicans in districts that Hillary won, that's all gone now. That slate's clean. They're all out. All the retirements are done. Now the Democrats are going to have to defend seats carried by Trump, right? So it flips over. And I think that's the big story to be told here.
Well, you're right, John. Look, the retirements were the single biggest factor in the Republicans losing the House. We had 42 or 43 Republican incumbents who decided to retire in districts that, if they had run or sought re-election, were very likely that we would have held at least half of those seats, giving us a 20-seat margin more than what we have right now, which would have been the majority. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, the problem that the Republicans face going into 2020 is the exact converse of the Senate map of what it was in 2018. We have a number of Republicans up in 2 years in very competitive states, and the Democrats don't have as many up. Now, 2 years in politics is a lifetime. People could die in office. They could leave. Who knows what could happen? But that being said, the Republicans definitely have more seats to defend in 2020, and I think you will find some bright spots coming out of the 2018 election. Look, John James in Michigan ran an unbelievably competitive race against Debbie Stabenow, who was supposed to be the 800-pound gorilla. He ran very well, and I would hope that John would run again in 2 years against the junior senator from Michigan, because with Donald Trump on the ballot, John James becomes the next U.S. senator from Michigan 2 years from now. Mm-hmm. But the other thing we've learned, John, and what the American people are once again focusing on, is the ballot integrity system that we have in this country is highly questionable. We're back to where we were 18 years ago with hanging chads and the chaos in Broward County and Palm Beach County. You know, Rick Scott is the winner of that U.S. Senate race. Ron DeSantis is the winner of that governor's race. But what we're seeing across the board, not just in Florida, but in Georgia and in other places, in New Mexico, is Democrats just happen to find ways to produce ballots that didn't exist on Election Day. I don't understand how this happens in this day and age. We were so concerned, the Democrats were so concerned of potential Russian interference in the 2016 election. Nobody is talking about the fact that the Board of Supervisors down in Florida has disregarded court orders, has not reported the number of ballots that were cast, and there's been no accountability, and we're still counting. We may not have the election results in Florida for another week or two in that U.S. Senate race, and I just don't understand how that happens anymore, John.
It's ridiculous, Corey. And, you know, now they find a box of provincial ballots and an Avis car rental, the back of the car. I mean, the incompetence there has been going on forever. But look, all the votes are in now. There's going to be a recount. It's a machine recount. This election is going to be certified. Rick Scott is going to win. He's got a 12,000 vote lead. DeSantis bigger than that. And in the history of machine recounts, there's never been an election where one candidate was ahead by 10,000 or over that was even close to changing it. You know, if you're 1,500 or something like that, that could happen. 12,000, it's done. Scott is going to win. Kemp is going to win in Georgia. I want to get to your book in a minute, but just looking at the Republicans up, Corey, very quickly here in 2020, and I'm going to just take 30 seconds on it. I'm going to go fast. These are seats that the Republicans are going to win. Tennessee, Alexander, Capito, West Virginia, Cassidy, Louisiana, Susan Collins might be tough, Maine, John Cornyn, Texas, Cotton, Arkansas, Steve Daines, Montana, NZ, Wyoming, Joni Ernst, Iowa, that might be a little hard. Cory Gardner in Colorado, that might be at play. Graham, he's going to win easy, South Carolina. Hyde Smith, Mississippi, will win. James Inhofe, Oklahoma, he'll win. Whoever is the Arizona senator, somebody's got to be in that seat. So then you go down the line, McConnell, Purdue in Georgia, Idaho, Robertson, Kansas. I mean, there's maybe two or three seats that are in play, but right away, the Democrats start off losing Alabama, they're not going to hold that seat. Right?
No, that's right. That's right. Look, we're going to win the Alabama seat, and I think for the Republicans, and I believe Cory Gardner would tell you this, he is probably the number one target
right.
in the country for an incumbent Republican senator. So,
right.
look, you're going to see money spent in Colorado. You're going to see a lot of money spent in Alabama. That's going to be a seat that comes back home to the Republicans. But just the fact that you've got that many incumbent U.S.
Right.
senators on the ballot means
right.
that resources are going to be diverted.
Right.
And so the opportunity to be on the offense is much harder in other places.
Right. And then, of course, the Susan Collins seat, they're going to spend as much money as they can trying to knock her out, you know, because you voted for Kavanaugh, obviously. So you got that. Corey Lewandowski here on the John Fredericks Radio Network, Truck the Truth Across America. Corey, I want to ask you about your new book coming out in just a week from today. You're going to have a big grand opening, if you will, with that. You're going to be touring the United States, Trump's enemies. What can we expect? Give us a little tidbit.
Well, look, this is the first and only book in the first 2 years of this presidency where the president sat down and gave a formal interview. And it's very important. It's very timely. We ask him about the midterms, and he answers the questions. We ask him about his thoughts on Andy McCabe and Jim Comey and Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. We ask about his relationship with Barack Obama and what that's like. We ask the greatest parts of being the president and the most difficult parts of being the president. It is a long, in-depth interview, but we also ask him about his enemies. We ask him about his relationship with the mainstream media and the press and the adversarial nature of it and what that means. So all of the things that the American people want to hear and want to know what the president is thinking, we have a verbatim discussion in there with the president, and he answers those questions very, very candidly. We ask about anonymous, and we ask about the people who served in his administration, who were supposed to be there to help him and were only there to hurt him. We talk about the people that Bob Woodward mentions in the book, and we ask the president his opinion. I think it's the first time he talks about those individuals, and he gives an in-depth story of how when he came to Washington, D.C., he didn't know the people that he does now. He didn't know what Washington, D.C. was really like and how deep the swamp is, but 2 years into it, he knows all the players, and what you're going to see, John, in my opinion, based on what we write about in the book, and what he talks about is you will see changes in his administration. You will see cabinet officials who are leaving who maybe he regrets having here in the first place. You know, the first cabinet official to leave after the midterms, Jeff Sessions, has already been announced. I anticipate more. I anticipate more staff changes in the building, which I think is a good thing for the president, because when he brings in individuals who knew him prior to being the president, I think of Larry Kudlow, John Bolton, Bill Shine, those individuals are there to serve the president and not themselves. And the more of those people he brings in, the better he will be and the better our country will be for it. So we talk all about it in the book.
Are you going to name names?
John, you know I'm going to name names. That's what I do. Look, I talk about the unelected bureaucrats from the State Department to other agencies. I talk about people very specifically who have been in that building. I give specific examples. Look, I don't hold back. You know I don't. And the reason I don't is because I am here to support the president. And, you know, John, I had a conversation with someone just last week, and I said, we have a new book coming out, Trump's Enemies. And the person said to me, am I in the book? And I said, why would you need to ask that question? And this is a person who, you know, is at least on the cursory edge of talking to the president on a fairly regular basis. And I said, if someone was writing a book and said, hey, Corey, the name of the book is Trump's Enemies, there is no equivocation. My name is not in that book. You understand, right? There's no question that I am not an enemy of the president. But so many people continue to do things which are against his will or don't help him, but they do it on the outskirts. They do it on the edges of the way he operates that they have to question if they made the book. And so, look, Dave and I were very honest in this book, as we were in the first book. Look, the Let Trump Be Trump book was a very honest assessment. This book is a very honest assessment. It has true intellectual honesty to it. I stand by every word of the book, and people are going to be very surprised about how honest the book is, because that's who we are. And by the way, that's what the president deserves, is honest people telling him the truth of when things are good, but also when things are bad.
When is it going to be released?
So it'll actually be out officially out 2 weeks from today. But We're going to start the media tour right after Thanksgiving. So we're going to be all over the country. We're really excited. If you pre-order the book now at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever you want to go, we really think it's going to be a great book. It's hopefully going to be as successful as the last book. And I want to thank your listeners for being so supportive of all of our efforts. But Trump's enemies, how the deep state is undermining this president, is the first book out after the midterms. It is the only book that the president gave an interview for. And I think listeners are going to love it.
All right, we're out of time. Trump's enemies, order it, pre-order it on Amazon now, Corey Lewandowski. And if you can get one over to me, when I will get him to sign it when we meet up over the next several days after it comes out. Former ambassador to Qatar, the U.S. ambassador to Qatar, 1995 to 1998. That was in the Clinton administration. He was a career officer, and he's now a strategic advisor to the Gulf International Forum, which is a new think tank based in Washington, D.C. Ambassador, great to have you, sir.
It's good to be on again.
All right, so I got to tell you,
Happy Armistice Day. I'm old enough to remember it that way.
Wow, Happy Armistice Day. That's right, and Happy Veterans Day.
Yeah.
And, Mr. Ambassador, I learned so much when you're on. Let's get to the Khashoggi affair. I find this horrific event. Now we find out there's a tape, right? Now, we knew there was a tape because Gina Haspel, the CIA director, went to Istanbul, and we kind of heard she had a tape, and she told the president what happened. Now the tape leaks out. Apparently they strangled Khashoggi when he got in there. Apparently they put a bag over his head. You can hear him on the tape, which Erdogan says of Turkey, their president, says they're going to release today, saying that they could hear him gasping for air and telling them to take the bag off his head. He couldn't breathe. Then he suffocated, which is a horrible way to die, very painful, with a bag over your head. And then they chopped him up and put him in acid. My heavens, what do you make of this whole thing?
Again, I wish that the Saudi, I mean, I don't wish them any more, but at least they should have consulted with the mafia on how to kill somebody. This is just howling incompetence. And then there's a certain brutality to all this. And there's I don't understand, frankly, what they were trying to accomplish. If you're sending a message to somebody, you're supposed to do it in public. If you're not sending a message to somebody, then you do it sort of clean and neat, and no one notices. But this is neither, it is both brutal, but, you know, for a country, in addition to being brutal, it was a horrifically incompetent way of doing it.
Let me ask you something, Mr. Ambassador. So Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was on the phone with the president, and the way we understand the readout is from the readout, the official readout of the conversation from the White House, was that MBS told the president that he was not aware of this, that it was rogue, and that there were 18 people involved, but he was not directing it, he didn't know anything of it, he didn't authorize it. Don't you find that almost astonishingly impossible to believe?
Yes. I mean, it's a little bit like buying a bridge in Brooklyn, but you know, there's no way they could have mobilized this much in the way of resources. This is two aircraft, senior people from the Saudi intelligence service. Unless somebody, the guy in charge, went totally bananas at the last minute and decided to kill him, but there was no reason. And these guys presumably are all professionals. Presumably they know what they were doing. So even if Mohammed bin Salman had played the old Henry II game, won't someone rid me of this troublesome priest? These are not the kinds of people who do that. Mm-hmm. These are professionals who presumably would do this.
Well, you had 18 people.
It just boggles the mind.
Yeah. So, look, it's inconceivable to anybody that follows any of this that MBS was not either involved in it, gave the order, directed the order, or managed it. The way they changed his story 15 times, even up to how he died. They said he was strangled. Right. Now we find out they put a bag over his head and tightened it. I mean, it's just, the stuff is beyond the pale. And, I mean, think of what the Saudis have said here. Basically, these are 18 rogue people that hijacked a Saudi plane, came to the embassy, came to Istanbul, had no authorization on it. And, like, what did they do? Like, go to the local Istanbul Walmart and say, hey, I need two barrels of acid that can...
Talk radio. AM 600, 101.1 FM, WBOB.
With SRN News, I'm Gordon Griffin. The Mexican Interior Ministry has said that it would immediately deport Central American migrants who tried to violently breach the border with the U.S. just south of California, and that it would reinforce the border. Meanwhile, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen said Sunday that U.S. authorities will continue to have a robust presence along the southwest border and that they will prosecute anyone who damages federal property or violates U.S. sovereignty. House Democrats set to vote this week on whether to nominate Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi for Speaker in the upcoming Congress. Those Democrats opposing her are hoping that a strategy of chaos will help them win out in the end. At present, no one has come forward as an alternative, but those against Pelosi believe that a show of opposition, even without a rival candidate, will be enough to prove that she can't win the House-wide vote in January and prompt alternatives to challenge her. This is SRN News.
Don't stress over a leaky or damaged roof. Just call Perkins Express Roofing. Perkins Express Roofing is available 24/7. If you've had damage from a storm or accident, there's a good chance insurance will cover it, and Perkins Express Roofing will do all of the paperwork for you. If you're remodeling, renovating, or building a new home or building, let Perkins Express Roofing's parent company, MCM Builders, do a free estimate and show you how much they can save you. From a leak to a whole roof, Perkins Express Roofing is locally owned and operated and totally licensed and insured. Your roof is one of the most important parts of your home. Trust the professionals at Perkins Express Roofing. Call 904-525-2277 or 626-2860. Currently hiring sales reps, equal opportunity employer. Perkins Express Roofing says, we keep you covered. 525-2277 or 626-2860. State license number CCC 133-0452.
I can give you a brand new kitchen in days, not weeks, not months. Hi, I'm Jeff Martin from Martin Appliance and Greystone Kitchens with my secret formula for your new kitchen. Quick and easy and economical. 90% of new cabinets today are painted. Modern colors, crisp and clean. 90% of new countertops are granite or quartz. Impeccably stylish, incredibly functional. Our secret? We swap your counters and refinish your cabinets to the color of your choice at a fraction of the cost. None of the hassle. And done in days. Call Greystone Kitchens at 213-9100 for your secret solution. Come see us on Phillips Highway across from Regal Cinema. That's Greystone Kitchens and Martin Appliance. New kitchen, new appliances. And if you want new cabinets, I can do that too. I'm a licensed contractor for crying out loud. Florida State License CGC 152-6479.
What you see is what you get. Martin Appliance Family.
Obama said the word nationalist and explained it, they wouldn't have any problem with it. But it's Trump. Trump represents an existential threat to mushy-headed liberalism. They know it. They have to take away the rhetorical devices and weapons and issues that Trump has successfully used against the left to expose the left. They have to remove those topics from his discussion.
Laura Ingraham, 9 to 11 a.m. on AM 600 and 101.1 FM, WBOB. The latest traffic and weather on WBOB, your 2018 election authority.
There certainly is what I'm calling it now, Blue-ginia. I mean, this state has become so Democratic and so blue, and they're turning their people out like never before because they have a machine. People fail to realize is the Democratic Party of Virginia has an operation. Right now, they've got 8 full-time people. Their offices are located in the SunTrust building in downtown Richmond. Their chairman, Susan Swecker, works there full-time. They have a staff of 8 people. And come January, they're adding another 20 in the field, so they'll have 28 people as they get prepared for the 2019 State Senate and House of Delegate elections in Virginia. And they're very well-funded, and they're funded through McAuliffe. The McAuliffe legacy endures in Virginia through the Democratic Party of Virginia. They have a real party. with get-out-the-vote operations, sign-up operations, registering operations, and they're strategically located in different parts of the states. The Republican Party, on the other hand, doesn't exist. It is John Finley, their executive director, I think one other guy, and somebody answers the phone, and that's it. Jack Wilson, their chairman, I mean, he lives along 460 there, or Suffolk or something. There's no apparatus. They have a postal permit. And I'm not knocking the Republican Party of Virginia, but I just want you to understand it doesn't exist. And infuriated me the other day when somebody said, well, the Republican Party of Virginia establishment didn't back Corey Stewart. Don't you get it? There is no establishment. There's nothing. I mean, right now, the last line of defense for a complete Democratic takeover of Virginia that will last for probably a generation, the last line of defense is Kirk Cox. He's it. He's got to raise his own money. He's the Speaker of the House. He's got to raise his own money, and he's got to figure out how to save his slim one-seat majority in the House of Delegates. Then we don't even know what the redistricting is. I mean, he's got a yeoman's job ahead of him. I mean, Tommy Norman's retiring at some point. He doesn't have the energy. The Senate's gone. There's no way they hold it. No way. The Democrats are going to win the Senate. And if they win the House, it's over. Because you have to remember, just in fundraising alone, they've got all the statewide office holders, two U.S. senators, 7 out of 11 congressmen, congresspeople, 7 of 11. So they have the governor. They have the attorney general. They have everything. So they have the ability to go out and do fundraisers and raise money, and the Republicans have no one. They have 4 congressmen and no statewide office holders, and they've lost 12 in a row. So this is not Jack's fault. I mean, he just took over, but he has an empty shell. So I just want to keep emphasizing what the Republicans here in Virginia are up against and how brutal the situation is, because there is no party. It doesn't exist. So stop telling me about the establishment. There's no establishment. There's no grassroots. There's nothing. There's nothing organized here. And there's no leadership. And I guess I should get off this topic. But I'm going to be blunt. The nomination of Corey Stewart for U.S. Senate by Republicans in the last cycle in June was the death knell. That was sticking a stake in your own heart. And so for you Republicans out there, I don't know what you're doing. You keep nominating people that bring the party to the lowest depths it can go. And I don't know if you feel good about that, like you just feel good walking out of the primary booth with a sticker on and you puff your chest out and say, yeah, I voted to kill the establishment. The ridiculous nomination of Corey Stewart, who ran around with people with tiki torches and had photo ops with white supremacists and ran around with Confederate flags flying, that ridiculous nomination cost you 2 seats in the House of Representatives. Was that worth it? Ask yourself, was that worth it? I hope you found it was. And look, I'm not blaming anybody for this. But how many times are Republicans going to go down this path and keep nominating people that are a disaster, that drag everybody else down with them because of conventions or whatever else the state central wants? There's no leadership. This party needs a chairman who can lead, inspire, and motivate and fire people up. And he has to, or she has to, be strong enough to stand up to a lot of these people on the state central committee that are fighting their own little fiefdom battles that I don't really care about. I could care less about any of them, like the 6th district. Well, whatever. Like, stop. You're getting killed. I mean, you're about to lose everything. Kirk Cox is the last inner defense. That goes, it's over. Republicans will be a minority in the Commonwealth of Virginia for your lifetime. They will never win it back because they'll never raise the money. The only chance they have now is to raise money because Kirk Cox is still the speaker and he still has the ability to fundraise. Once he's in the minority and there's nobody in the Senate and there's nobody in Congress and there's nobody in, at the statewide level, you get nothing. For those listening to me out there, you need to grasp what is going on here and the dire straits that Virginia is in for Republicans. This is a blue aqua state. And they lose the House, it's over. This Cox is the only guy that has the ability to raise money. And for the Republicans out there thinking about it, well, we're gonna do primary challenges for those people that voted against, that voted for Medicaid expansion. We're going to challenge Glenn Davis, and we're going to challenge Joe Vogel, and we're going to challenge Frank Wagner. We're going to do primary battles, and we're going to show them. Seriously, folks? Show them what? What exactly are you going to show them?
Well, we're going to show them that, you know, the establishment, and they sold us out. They went for Medicaid expansion, and so we're going to primary them and get them out of there.
Why don't you just guarantee you lose everything? The only person that can win that seat in Virginia Beach is Frank Wagner. If he's out, you're done. You lose that. Now, what about Joe Vogel? The only person who's going to save that seat is Joe Vogel. It's insanity. It is suicide. Kamikaze. That's my message to you Republicans out there. Don't be telling me about the grassroots.
It's the grassroots. We got to do the grassroots.
No. Your back's against the wall. Just get it. You're going to lose the Senate. You have virtually 5% chance of keeping it. Sturdivant seats at risk. Siobhan Dunnevant seats at risk. Dick Black's a goner. That seat's gone. Forget it. Mail it in. That's gone all blue. He's not going to win. He doesn't have the energy. He should retire. He's not going to win. And I like Dick Black. I'm a friend of Dick Black's. I just tell it like it is. And I'm tired of the nonsense that is going on here. Reeves is going to have a challenge. And the two most vulnerable seats are Black and Sturdivant. And it's going to take a miracle to hold them. And all they need is one, and they have control because they have the lieutenant governorship. So they're going to win a seat. It's gone. All you have is the House. That's it. That goes. Katie bar the doors. It's over. Last line of defense. John Frederick's radio network. I'm not going to lie to you. And a lot of people criticized me for predicting that Barbara was going to win in the 10th. You know what? I talked to that campaign every day. They were convinced that they had a firewall. They were convinced that her brand was going to carry them over the top. They had internal polling up to the final day that had them up one. Oh, it didn't work out. You know, each campaign that I go through, and I'm 60 years old, and I've been through a lot of these since Reagan 76 is when I started, when he got beat by Gerald Ford in Kansas City as a very young man. Now, I'm not a political operative. It's not the business I'm in. I've been in the media forever as an executive in different things. That was my first campaign I was involved in. And I worked for a lot of presidential candidates, from Reagan to Pat Buchanan to Jack Kemp to Steve Forbes on down. But you always try to learn something in every cycle. And I always go back and say, okay, what did I learn? What did I learn? I learned two things. The internal polling that the Republicans are doing is false, because they kept telling me what their internal polls were and how accurate they were, and they were all wrong. So I no longer trust that, just like I don't trust the fake polls. The Republican internal polls were no better. I mean, to say for months that Barbara was up by one, she gets beat by 12, how's that math work? I mean, the Taylor people were telling me they were outside of the margin of error. They got swamped. So there's a new Democratic voter who's showing up that is on nobody's radar screen, just like the Trump voter in 2016 was on no one's radar screen. So polling here is very inaccurate on all sides. That's one thing I learned. Here's the second thing I learned. Whining isn't a strategy. We had a lot of whining going on in Virginia by some candidates. A lot of whining. Whining is not a prescription to win an election. Here's the third thing I learned. Barbara Comstock is one of the toughest, most competitive, honorable women that I've ever met in this cycle. And I was at odds with Barbara for a long time over her never-Trumper attitude on a bunch of things. We reconciled somewhere along the way back in the spring. I went to her office, sat down with her. I apologized for being mean to her. We had a great conversation and went from there. But I learned during this campaign what an honorable woman Barbara is, because she got outspent. The district was becoming impossible to win. She came on my show every week. She worked her tail off. She worked 19 hours a day, 7 days a week, tirelessly. And she did it with honor. And she never whined, and she never complained. And she really believed that she was going to win. And so she convinced me she was going to win. And I don't mind predicting it the wrong way, because she made a believer out of me. And her attitude, her positive can do, I'm going to do this. She didn't blame anybody else. She didn't blame Trump. She didn't blame the district. She didn't blame the Democrats. She didn't get enough money. She didn't blame anybody. Never one time did she get on my show, and she came on every single week. Never one time did she get on, come on and whine about $10 million or $15 million or $20 million or what the Democrats were doing, or, you know, the slanderous ads against her. Not a peep out of her. She went to every event, and she's an honorable woman. And I don't know what she's going to do after this, but here's what I learned in this campaign. I learned to respect Barbara Comstock. I learned to respect her as a person, as a campaigner, as a representative, and as a woman with unboundless energy that believed in something, that took personal responsibility for everything that went on and never blamed anybody else. And never one time did I hear Barbara Comstock whine about money or anything else. She just worked. That's all she knows how to do. And it didn't turn out for Barbara. But we lost an honorable woman. And this is coming from someone that was at odds with her for a long time. I didn't back her in any of these races until the end. And so she taught me a lot. If you're going to lose, lose with dignity and guns blazing. And that's what she did. She fought to the final minute. She never gave up. She never quit. She never whined. She never complained. And so I gained a tremendous amount of respect for her. And what I learned is that in politics, if you're in a tough situation, you just keep fighting. And you do it the right way. And even if you do lose, you lose with honor. And you don't have to stick your head between your legs or your tail or whatever one does and slink away. Barbara fought a good fight, and she taught me a lot. And I thank Barbara Comstock for that. Joining us now is Sam Nunberg. Sam, longtime political operative for Donald J. Trump, was on the Trump campaign 2015, and now he's part of Steve Bannon's C4 operations. I call it CAR, Citizens for the American Republic. They were very involved in this past election, and things were going great for us until we somehow got beat in Arizona. That's a big blow, because Kyrsten Sinema, not exactly... she's very liberal, and I thought McSally was ahead. We all thought she was going to win that, but didn't turn out that way. Joining us now, we're trying to break all this down, Sam Nunberg. Sam, good to have you with us, man.
John, thank you for inviting me on.
So after the midterms, I went over to Steve Bannon's bash there in Washington, D.C. It had a lot of people there. It had a big turnout, but I want to talk about the Arizona race, because we all thought that night, we all thought we were going to win that. What happened?
You know, it's very interesting. I think Maricopa County shows what happened there, actually. It's a county that the president, I believe, beat Hillary Clinton by over 60,000 votes. And in fact, the governor, Governor Ducey, he won that county, Sinema won the county as well. So you had a lot of split tickets there. And I think that is not a national issue. You know, I've heard I heard from friends in Iowa, too, where Governor Kim Reynolds was able to win, yet we lost two House seats, that there were split tickets. I think in that case, look, Sinema was thought of as someone who had been campaigning, an extremely good campaigner, canvasser. She was a grassroots organizer. And McSally, I thought McSally did extremely well during her primary. But the one issue was, John, is she didn't – one mistake I heard from multiple radio hosts was she wouldn't go on their shows. If right. you had invited her on, she wasn't going to go on. She didn't go on the Mark Levin show. She didn't go on the Hannity show. She didn't go on Fox News, I don't believe, once. So I don't understand what their thinking was there. I thought that – it's very difficult when, look, in general, one of the things, the reasons why the president was able to win the primary in 2016, and I believe had he not won, Ted Cruz would have won, was because they ran for the utmost as conservatives, as outsiders. The president ran as a conservative and an outsider. And he didn't have the problems that a John McCain or a Mitt Romney had in 2008 and 2012. McSally did have those problems. I thought she performed well in her debates. I watched them. But look, and the bottom line is, too, is remember, she was replacing Jeff Flake. And while I'm sure Jeff Flake theoretically wanted a Republican to replace him on paper, in light of the fact of the way he's acted after the election, I think that he is probably happy that a Democrat ended up taking the seat, and it was a contested thing. I had said earlier that the two most important Senate races that day of this cycle were going to be Nevada and Arizona, because if we held them, then everything else was going to be gravy. With that said, we'll see what happens. Apparently, John Kyle wants to leave in January, and Dutch and Governor Ducey may install her there. I think that she could be a leader of the party, but yeah, she made some mistakes. These are typical mistakes that you and I have complained about over the years about candidates, and I don't understand what the late term strategy was.
Well, not going on talk radio made no sense. You know, you have a lot of candidates that they're afraid to go on talk radio. They don't really know the host. They don't vet them. But, you know, when they're afraid of getting a tough question from a Mark Levin or a John Fredericks or whatever, whoever might be out there. But it's really a big mistake because, you know, a Trump base listens to talk radio. Every study has shown that. I don't think that made any sense at all. I thought that was a really mistake. And she wouldn't go on Fox. I mean, they ran a kind of a keep away campaign, and they thought if they just didn't say anything out of text or nothing, no mistakes, that it was a Republican state and they could just win. And that's just not the way it works now. So
no, it isn't. And, you know, one thing in general I would say is, look, these results weren't what I wanted. By the way, I think I saw you there at the end of the night at the party. I was so out of it, John, so I apologize for not going to say hello. I didn't even know, you know, Steve Bannon, we did this streaming during the election. I didn't even know we were doing this until 15 minutes before we started. So, but what I would say is that I think it also goes to the fact that, look, we also lost, she also lost her House seat there that she had left. And that was a seat that we weren't going to pick up. We figured we were going to lose it from the very beginning. And she'd come from one of those districts of the 24 districts that Hillary Clinton won, which a Republican was able to keep in 2016. Of those, we only won three of them this time. And I think one of the main reasons that we ended up losing the House, actually a couple of reasons. The first is the bomber, the pipe bomber. It may not be fair, it may not be right, but remember, if we were looking at all these polls and these generic congressional polls, which for the most part, I do want to applaud ABC and NBC, Wall Street Journal. They were accurate, as opposed to fake news CNN, which released a poll the Monday before the Tuesday election showing the Democrats with a 13-point generic congressional lead. Those polls could get, John, 8-7 points towards the end. But the problem was each of those polls, and also one other private poll that I saw, you had 10% of undecided. And I don't think that we were able to I think if they were a wash, then those are people that were probably trending towards us. But they, at the end of the day, decided to go either stay home or go with the Democrat. And these things happen. It certainly wasn't the result that I wanted. But if you look at some of the races, the Democrats had a lot of advantages. They keep complaining about gerrymandering. They had advantages in terms of those 24 House seats. They got some seats, the 24 that Hillary Clinton won, Republican won. Then they got two races, which they should not have won. One race was typical. It was the South Carolina race where the Republican was primaried. I think he helped the Democrat win. Then you had a race in Oklahoma, which came out of nowhere, that we ended up losing. And I think that on the other hand, too, when you look at Virginia, or you look at New Jersey, or you look at California, those were states, although California is a separate issue, those were states where we barely lost some of those races. The Dave Brat race, we could have won, and the Scott Taylor race, we could have won. I think both of them lost for separate reasons going into those specific races. But one of the main reasons they lost is I heard an interview, and it was very funny. I heard an interview from the DCCC, the guy running the DCCC or whatever their outside group, the main group. And one of the things he had said particularly was he didn't understand why the Congressional Leadership Fund, Paul Ryan's super PAC, where they were spending their money sometimes. And two of the people he had mentioned were Mike Kaufman in Colorado and what's her name in Virginia 10? I can't even remember her name.
Barbara Comstock.
But the same thing about both of them were they both voted against repealing Obamacare.
Right.
You know, of the 20 Republicans that voted against repealing Obamacare, there were 10 moderate Republicans, there were 10 conservatives. Each of those conservatives ended up winning. The 10 moderates, you had 6 retirees. We lost all those seats. And we lost the 4, and we lost the 4 that were running for reelection. But I think that that's something where I go into the money is you. I didn't understand this. I'm not out to look. We don't have Paul Ryan, frankly, to kick around anymore. I don't think he made the specific decision, but don't tell me that money, that money couldn't have been better spent, that they spent on Comstock to Dave Brat.
Well, they didn't like Dave. They didn't like Dave. He didn't play ball with them. He didn't toe the line. He didn't do the caucus thing. He was a wild card. I mean, he did what he wanted. And so, you know, he never really endeared himself to any of the Republican leadership. And at the end of the day, you still had the Eric Cantor factor going on. And they wanted him out. And so Dave is out. As simple as that. And but look, what you just said is very interesting. I just want our audience to understand this, why I'm so optimistic right now about 2020. So there were 26 congressional seats or districts that Hillary Clinton carried in 2016 with Republican.
Not to be a nitpicker, 24,
Congress.
But yes, 24.
24, I'm sorry. There were 24 seats. The Democrats won back 21 of those, right? So the Republicans only held 3 of those seats. So if they gained, let's say they gained 33, I think that's what they'll end up with. 21 of those seats are in districts that Clinton carried. Many of the Republicans retired or stepped down or whatever, but they were successful in that. Those are the ones they had to win. They were able to get the people out